Welcome to Conduit Conversations, bringing you pioneers at the cutting edge of social change. I'm Paul Fonsale, co-founder of The Conduit, a place that brings together people passionate about positive impact.
If we say, actually, it's traced down to 200 Russian bots who are constantly trying to stir up racial hatred, and they were being shared with captions designed to stir up racial hatred, and Facebook did nothing about blocking those 200 accounts, but simply took down the video one after another, I can say, Facebook, come on. Like, that's not the will of the people, and that's not what people are trying to share as a matter of free expression.
My guest today is Jimmy Wales, an internet entrepreneur best known as the co-founder of Wikipedia, not-for-profit online encyclopedia. Born in Huntsville, Alabama, Jimmy studied finance before becoming an options trader in Chicago. Jimmy launched Wikipedia on the 15th of January, 2001. The platform is now one of the most referenced, most used repositories of knowledge on the planet, with more than 40 million articles in 293 languages, all freely available. Jimmy's role in creating Wikipedia prompted Time magazine to name him one of the 100 most influential people in the world. He was inducted into the Internet Hall of Fame in 2013, and in September 2017, he was awarded the President's Medal of the British Academy. Jimmy Wales, welcome to Conduit Conversations.
Thank you.
So you grew up in Huntsville, Alabama, during the height of the space program. Tell us a little bit about your childhood. Were you always fascinated by information and data?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I grew up at a time when Huntsville, Alabama was a real boom town due to the space program. We lived close enough to where they tested the Saturn V rockets that sometimes it would rattle the windows in the house. So, and we didn't live that close, but we lived close enough. So it was all very exciting, technology and science. And, you know, growing up, my family really valued education. So we had a full set of encyclopedias in the house, of course, which I spent many, many hours reading over. And, yeah, that was sort of what set me off on this path.
And when did you decide, or when did you realize that you were wanted to be both an entrepreneur, but somebody who worked in the kind of digital internet space?
Well, my my family was always very entrepreneurial. My mother started a music school, a private school. My uncle had a music store and then later a computer store. And when he got the computer bug himself, my mom was always a gadget freak and went out and bought the same computer he had, which was a Radio Shack TRS-80. And then soon after that, he started his computer store, and I would, you know, as a teenager, I worked there part-time, helping him out with customers on the weekend. So had access to computers fairly early on, and, you know, at that time, you know, really thought I'd like to be an entrepreneur. But, of course, this is pre the internet, really, or at least it wasn't accessible to me at that time.
So everybody who does something extraordinary and world-changing has some set of prior either business or entrepreneurial experiences that equip them to do the thing that they become famous for. Mm. So unless you're one of those remarkable exceptions who just did Wiki first, what did you do beforehand that led you to the insights that helped form Wikipedia?
Yeah, well, I mean, going all the way back, I mean, in terms of being an entrepreneur, one of the things that I did is sort of a classic bit of Americana is I had a paper route and rode my bicycle around throwing the newspapers. And the way that worked is you didn't get paid a salary for that. You bought the papers at wholesale and then you got people to subscribe and you had to go collect the money. And if you didn't collect the money, then you didn't get paid and so forth. So it really taught you a lot of responsibility about, you know, income and outflow and trying to make sure, you know, it's sustainable. Later on, I was a futures and options trader in Chicago after doing work towards a PhD in finance, which I never finished because I decided to go off and be a trader instead. And then I got really interested about the growth of the internet. I remember I remember the day that Netscape went public, and I had been really into the internet and the web before that, and Netscape was worth $4.3 billion on the first day. And prior to that, I had, just as a hobby, been writing my own web browser at night and on the weekends. I didn't have a life back then. I worked as a trader in the day and then did coding at night. And I realized that my home-built web browser was not as good as Netscape 1.0, but it wasn't $4 billion worse. You know, I was like, wow, the market is really telling us this is something that a lot of work is going to flow into. And so then decided, okay, like, this is interesting. The internet is going to be a thing, and I need to start exploring and figuring out ideas. And I had different failed ideas. I do a talk sometimes for young entrepreneurs called Failure. Jimmy Wales is really good at it. So detailing different business ideas that I had that I tried and didn't work out. One of my favorite was called Loop Lunch, because the downtown Chicago is called The Loop. And it was a food ordering service where you could order food and have it delivered. But at that time, this is in probably 96, 97, local restaurant owners looked at me like I was from Mars when I tried to convince them that they should be on the internet. They had no idea what I was talking about. So that was too early. Now, of course, with things like Deliveroo and Uber Eats, it's obviously a huge business, but I didn't know what I was doing. So Castro and a lot of different things. We did some early blogging, but never really cracked the formula there. Had a kind of a search engine. But the main thing that grew out of all that was Wikipedia in the end, after trying lots of different things.
So you launched Wikipedia sort of as an experimental endeavor in some ways.
Definitely, Well, I had a prior project called Newpedia, which was a very top-down, very old-fashioned encyclopedia. We had a seven-stage review process to get anything published. It was, you know, it was driven by the idea that we had to be really, really serious to be taken seriously. But it actually turned out it was too difficult for volunteers. It was too much effort to get anything published. It was a very intimidating process. And so after a couple of years, we threw that over and tried the wiki, and just said, let's just get started writing stuff and let's see what happens. And then that, you know, we got more work done in, I would say, in 2 weeks than we had in almost 2 years. So I was like, okay, wow, this is a substantially different beast.
And how did you crack this idea? I mean, today, you know, Wikipedia is just part of the general canon of knowledge in the world. But back then, I think the idea that knowledge flowed from experts and that only a few people were permitted to be the purveyors of knowledge. And Wikipedia actually just turned it on its head. Did you confront incredible skepticism at the early days, and how did you overcome that?
To some extent, and to some extent we still do, but I think one of the things that was important is the idea that Wikipedia is not anti-experts, it's not anti-expertise, but it's saying, let's recognize that expertise is much more widely distributed in society than we had previously thought. And one of the ways I like to talk about this is to think about a sort of the bearded math professor, your classic sort of geeky math professor, but who also has a love of Elizabethan poetry. And because they're a math professor, even within math, they're forced into a very narrow subspecialty. And yet, if you really step back and say, well, actually, this is a well-rounded intellectual who has great many different intellectual interests and hobbies, not relating to his professional career. And I have a particular person in mind, and he writes really great stuff on Elizabethan poetry and knows a huge amount about it and is very respectful of people who are in that field. So the fact that he's not, in a certain sense, an expert in that field, but a very talented amateur, doesn't mean that he disrespects the experts in that field. It just means he's able to write an encyclopedia entry, which is, you know, generally general knowledge is, you know, it's not at the cutting edge. He's not trying to innovate new theories. He's just basically saying, here's the theories that are out there. Here's the current consensus thought, and so on. And it turns out there are a lot of people in a lot of different fields. The other thing is that Wikipedia is not particularly snobby in the old-fashioned way about what counts as a topic worthy of discussion. And so normally you wouldn't think you would open up Encyclopedia Britannica in the old days and find huge detailed compendium of information about Britney Spears' career. But it's a huge part of culture, and why not have it in an encyclopedia? And they had good reasons for having to be restricted. Paper is expensive, and you can only write so many volumes, and their whole process of getting academics to write serious, thoughtful things didn't lend itself well to pop culture and lots of other things that are perfectly valid human interests.
So Wikipedia works in part because it's compendious. It's just this extraordinary array of knowledge, you know, virtually anything that you want to research and look up, it's there. But that wasn't always the case. And what's made it valuable required it becoming compendious. So firstly, when did you have an insight that this was going to become viral and large and huge in ways that perhaps you never dreamt of?
Well, I mean, I think fairly early on, there were a couple of things I could point to. So first of all, the main way that people would find Wikipedia in the early days, and this continues today, is type something they're interested in into a search engine. So if you typed in Queen Victoria and you got a decent entry explaining who Queen Victoria was and when she lived and the basic facts of history, that was already useful even if the rest of the encyclopedia was empty. And so it turns out that, you know, as long as the individual articles are good, even though it's not a full compendium of all human knowledge yet, it's useful enough that it attracts people to say, oh, okay, yeah, this is good, this is useful. And then part of it is that our early community was very passionate about the project and the idea of a free encyclopedia for everyone in their own language. And we mean that in a very global sense. We mean, you know, it's freely licensed, it's there for everyone. That's an inspirational goal. And so people were very eager to see it succeed. And so, you know, in a certain sense, even though it was a volunteer community, they were just as competitive as any sort of dot-com entrepreneurs and sort of incentivized by stock options at Google or anywhere else. I remember in the early days, I used to post a list from time to time by going through our access logs and seeing where was traffic coming from. And so I'd post a list, what Google likes. And I would say, this is the traffic we're getting from Google this week. These are the kinds of topics that people are coming to us for. And the community would look at that and they would say, oh, wow, look, actually three of the top 20 topics are having to do with World War II. So that's a popular topic in history. And obviously people are clamoring for information. So they would say, okay, let's find more information about World War II. And so they would write the Battle of the Bulge and the attack on Pearl Harbor and things that they knew would be popular because they wanted Wikipedia to be successful and to reach out. And then, of course, other people, because it is volunteers, had zero interest in that, and they would follow their own obscure interests, whatever those might be. And, you know, knowing that, well, maybe no one's going to read much about stochastic differential equations, but if they do, we'll have a good explanation. And so, you know, all different people with all different kinds of motivations, but they were all about that ideal of sharing knowledge with everyone.
So in retrospect, this was always going to be a great idea. But I think everybody who's ever built something always knows that great ideas are perhaps 20% of what makes something fantastic.
For sure, yeah.
And remarkable entrepreneurs have to do many things around design, incentives, structure, and confront many sort of challenges and moments of near death on the route. So tell us what you did that harnessed this intuitive yearning of people to want to create knowledge in this way, but actually turn it into something real.
Well, I think one of the big shifts was something we already talked about, the shift from a top-down, permission-oriented culture to a be bold and just create and let's improve it as we go along culture. When we switched from Newpedia to Wikipedia, that made a huge difference. You know, further was just the idea of saying, look, because Wikipedia started really growing in the depths of the dot-com crash. And what that meant was there was no way to raise money. There was no investment money available. Silicon Valley, the window was closed. And that meant that we had to innovate on our whole community process. So if I had had access, if I'd been able to go to Silicon Valley and raise $10 million, the natural way you would think is, okay, we've got some kind of a problem on the site, so we need to hire moderators. and the moderators will make these decisions. And we didn't have the money to do that. It wasn't a live option. And so this is what happened, I would say, if you look at places like YouTube, places like Twitter, Facebook, all the places, they have a system of community management that basically involves faceless moderators paid by the company making, you know, decisions about whether to block someone, whether to ban someone, and so forth. Obviously, they have their own blocking tools for the community to use, but in Wikipedia, that's 100% all done in the community. There really is very, very little intervention at all. But it only works not by magic. It only works. We had to build the social structures to make it work. So we have administrators who are elected from the community, and they have certain standards, and they can lose their admin bit if they aren't doing it right. We have the arbitration committee, which is a more higher elected body that settles more harder long-term disputes, things like that. So we developed these structures over time, and also the ethos and the values and the rules. So things like our biography of living persons policy basically says that if there's unsourced negative information about someone in a biography, it should be removed immediately. Not, oh, I should go find a source of that. Remove it immediately. It doesn't have a source. Go to the talk page and say, hey, this said this. There's no source. And then if somebody may look it up and say, well, actually, it said that, you know, this person was convicted of murder and turns out they were convicted of murder, but you still can't get in trouble for removing it if there's not a source. If they said, well, look, it was in the New York Times, so we can put it in, of course, right? And those kinds of rules that are really about respecting human dignity are really important to us. Another rule of Wikipedia is no personal attacks. So if you're engaged in a discussion, so let's say you and I we're working on some entry about something emotional, something for you maybe, something South African, and we get into a fight about it. If I just start attacking you as a person rather than saying, hey, look, we need to improve the article, let's look at the sources, I see your perspective, but there are other historians who disagree with that, we have to at least cover that, then I'm good. But if I just say, oh, come on, you're an idiot, you're trying to whitewash history, or you're trying to do this or that, then I'll get in trouble because that's just not the proper behavior. Of course, we're human beings at Wikipedia. People get in fights. They do yell at each other. But it's always that deep ethos in the community that that's not the right way. The right way is to say, okay, come on, we're in it together. Let's try and figure out the right answer. Wikipedia won't necessarily be my view of the world, but it should explain all the relevant views of the world in a fair way. And the truth is, most people really get that. It's hard to imagine that most people really get that in an era of Twitter, for example, where it all seems to be about just bashing the other person and trying to score cheap points. At Wikipedia, we try to be more thoughtful, more slow, more reflective. And I don't mean to imply that it's paradise and perfect. We do have our social problems in Wikipedia. You know, the classic kind of problem is somebody who does really, really good work, but they're also very prickly. And so they tend to lash out at people. And it's like, oh, then we have a really hard problem because they've got their defenders who say, yeah, but look at this amazing work they're doing. And we're like, yeah, but look at all the people they're driving off as well. So it's very messy and human, but it's very different as well from any other, you know, social project that I know about, simply because the purpose of Wikipedia is to build an encyclopedia, not to maximize page views, not to get more editors, get more users. None of those things are really as important as the fundamental, which is, does this improve the encyclopedia or not? And that's our fundamental value.
So you struck on something wildly important and relevant to our times, which is, on the one hand, the way we get news, current affairs, and our politics seems increasingly fragmented, partisan, echo chambers. We live in our own little heuristic bubbles. Mm. And then you have this remarkable thing called Wikipedia, which is more thoughtful, more collegial. And I don't mean to idealize it, but but it seems clear that it is a more civil platform capable of dealing with discussion, disagreement, debate, and dissent. Mm-hmm. It feels as if the latter is winning in the world today. And I wonder if, A, you think that's true, and B, whether there are things that one can do to take the kind of, you know, for want of a better word, wiki ethos and insert it into our present.
Yeah. I mean, it's really hard. You know, when I think a lot about these kinds of issues with respect to Twitter, for example. So Twitter is, you know, notoriously quite an aggressive place. It's a place where lots of misinformation is shared. But the thing about Twitter is, by its very design and the very purpose of Twitter, it's not to create an encyclopedia. It's to create a platform for people to express their opinions. And so I'm very sympathetic to the problem that Twitter faces as a company. If people are expressing opinions that are incorrect, factually mistaken, well, that's not really for Twitter to decide. I can understand why it's not really for Twitter to decide. But also, I do think that they have some kind of a responsibility around, and I'm not suggesting regulation. That opens a whole other can of worms. But a moral responsibility, a responsibility even to be a successful company in the long run, to provide tools and environments so that people say at the end of the day, Twitter makes my life better, not I'm slightly addicted to Twitter and I find it very annoying, but I can't stop. Like, that's not a sustainable business model. We're saying Twitter's fantastic because of X, Y, and Z. These are the things that make it meaningful to me. That's a sustainable business in the long run. So this morning I saw someone on Twitter, I was randomly looking at Twitter, and someone on Twitter said, I just saw something about the uptick in measles, both in the UK and in the US. And the questions, you know, around anti-vaccination activists and things like that. So that's fine. I'm interested in the topic. But then I see a guy who says, everybody's talking about this and anti-vaccination, and that's all fine, but they're also politically correct. Nobody wants to talk about the millions of illegal immigrants coming to the U.S. who are unvaccinated. And that's really what's driving this. And I thought, oh, okay, I'm pretty sure that's false. Because I read a fact check a couple weeks ago about that. I went and did some homework. I mean, this is how I waste my time when I should have been doing work this morning. And I found, you know, Mexico has a higher rate of vaccination than the U.S. Mexico, for the most recent 3 years that I could find, so I can't say about last year, had zero cases of the measles. And so the idea that all these poor diseased savages are crawling across the border and infesting our beautiful, pristine country is just false. And okay, so that's fine. Somebody's wrong on Twitter. Maybe I should just relax, right? But I did think, my next thought was, oh, maybe I should tweet this guy with a quick link saying, actually, you know, you've got your facts a bit wrong. And then I'm like, I don't even want to get into that fight. And I looked at all of the people responding to him, and they're all like, yes, yes, yes. The lefties don't want to admit the real problem, build the wall, build the wall. He's a big Trump fan. I was like, I don't think I can engage in a thoughtful conversation with this person in this environment. I think if this person were in a different environment, if we were sitting here around the table, and I said, hey, like, actually, why don't we go together and let's look at the vaccination rates, let's look at the actual facts, and let's see, I'm willing to learn something, are you? Most people, actually, you get them sort of in the right environment, and they're like, yeah, okay, I don't mean to be spouting misinformation. And I can even say to someone, you can believe that measles is not coming across the border and still be against an open immigration policy. Those are different issues. You can base your dislike of immigration on other factors. That's completely fine, but let's make sure you're doing it on the right path. So anyway, I could go on for hours and hours, but I am concerned that we have too many spaces online that aren't guiding people or allowing people to come together in a way that says, actually, let's find some sort of an understanding of the issue. Because until we have an understanding, if I say, I think it's a foolish idea to build a wall, and what this person is seeing is, you know, thousands of children with measles and children dying of measles because of my preference for the policy, it's really hard for them to hear me. And it's really hard for me to hear them about their reasons if I don't even believe what they're talking about. So anyway, I'd like to see some methods online, better methods for people to come together and be thoughtful together.
So I think this is a crisis of our times. I think it's a crisis of our democracy. I think it it's a real, real challenge for how we think about the world and how we think about politics and about policy and about decision making. So, you know, everybody talks about the Polder model and the way that the Dutch make decisions, and the kind of myth is that everybody sits behind a dike and says there's one set of irrefutable facts, that the ocean's on the other side of this dike. And if we don't work together to keep out the ocean, we all drown. And therefore, a set of anchoring facts allow us to have a real conversation about, well, what's the best way to build the dike? What are you going to do on this side? How do you future-proof it? Because we have a fact that we agree on. The world we live in now is that the set of things that we call facts are increasingly contested. Climate change is contested on Twitter. You've just said basic facts around vaccination are contested on Twitter. And when you can't anchor yourself on one set of shared facts, it makes policy and politics and decision-making very difficult. And what you tend to do is just yell at each other. Mm-hmm. So this doesn't happen on Wikipedia. I don't have a great degree of confidence that Twitter is a platform where you can change the incentive structures to allow for this. But yet, it is dominating our politics more than Wikipedia is dominating our politics. So, solve.
It's a tough one. It's a really tough one because, you know, I remember a lot of concern that people had about echo chambers, for example, in the heyday of blogging. And I was not convinced by that, because I thought, actually, most of the blogs I read, and I would agree, I tend to read blogs I agree with, so there is a bit of echo chamber, but they're all linking to the blogs they disagree with, and they're having debates with them. So it's not like by reading a particular blog that I'm not being exposed to the other side. I'm seeing it from a lens, of course, but at least I'm seeing the other side. And nowadays we have, to a very large extent, we are in bubbles that we're not seeing the other side even. So that we can move from Twitter, which isn't so bad about that because everybody's arguing with everybody on Twitter. But on Facebook, I sort of had this realization. So I've got a lot of friends from Silicon Valley and sort of old, U.S., very libertarian type of friends. And then I'm here in the U.K. and I've got my sort of Labour Party lefty friends. And they're all thoughtful, kind people, right, who have different views on various philosophical matters. And I think I was proud of myself. I'm very proud of my group of friends that if a debate breaks out on Facebook about what is the proper role of government in healthcare, right? I've got my doctor friend in the U.S. who thinks that socialized medicine is a disaster, but who's very thoughtful and can detail why he thinks that's a problem and what he thinks is wrong with the U.S. system. I've got people here who rapidly support the NHS and that model and so on. And it's going to be a good debate, and that's great. And you can come down on either side and still be a reasonable person. But then I realized 100% of all of my friends despise Donald Trump. And I realized, even though I think I've got diversity, I don't really, because there are huge numbers of people out there who voted for Donald Trump, who believe in Donald Trump, who it's very easy for us to demonize and think of as basically a bunch of racist idiots, right? Some of them are. On the other hand, when they make a parody of some like loony bin politically correct lefties, okay, those exist too, right? And so it's like we're missing a big piece. And we've seen this here in the UK as well around the issue of Brexit, where if you live in London and you travel in certain social circles and are a member of the Conduit Club, you probably don't know too many people who are in favor of Brexit. And yet they're out there. And it's very easy to make the huge, huge intellectual error of just assuming they're all idiot racists who were manipulated by Russian propaganda and failing to say, actually, it was kind of a protest vote. They do have some of the facts wrong, but they've got some of the facts right. And there's a lot out there that we haven't heard because we're in a bubble. And that bubble makes it really hard to hear from people about what are their concerns, their legitimate needs, what are the things that are going to fix the country, get us back on path. And obviously Brexit continues until it's all finished one way or the other. It's going to be hard to have any kind of a healing because everybody's still, you know, we've seen in Parliament you know, how many consecutive votes where none of the available options can get a majority. Everybody's still holding out for their first best choice. Everybody thinks they're going to win this. Meanwhile, we're in complete limbo. And, you know, I'm a big fan of the idea, a few MPs have been putting forward, idea of some kind of citizen assembly, some kind of method of bringing people together to work on solutions that are outside of the media bubble, that are outside of Twitter, outside of this purely combative, where you can sit people together and say, hey, look, there's a lot we're never going to agree on. That's okay. But we can find ways forward that are helpful. We can find compromises that we can live with. And I do think we're going to need that. And this is, you know, this is about Brexit, which is a fundamentally important issue, but it's not even as upsetting as, you know, it's not like Israel-Palestine, where there's decades of violence behind that dispute. There's very little violence, I won't say none, around the Brexit issue. But, you know, we actually have the opportunity to heal. We have the opportunity to think this thing through in a better way. But I don't know if we will. I hope we will.
So one solution seems to be abandon the news as we have it currently, revert to citizen assemblies, put citizens in genuine dialogue, whether it's Brexit or the environment, as Extinction Rebellion is calling for as well. Let's get thoughtful people across the divide to sit in rooms and fashion solutions that politicians seem incapable of doing. We still need some fix for the media, right? The business model that we've had in the media has been fundamentally disrupted by search. Google and others have really upended traditional sources of revenue that funded your local newspaper, that you got your kind of local news. And I know you thought a lot about what that new business model for news might be, and it's very hard and the answers are not at all easy. But just sketch out for us some ways of thinking about where a new model for news might be. Maybe you come to the conclusion there isn't one, but but help us and think about how do we think about rebuilding a new model for news.
So I have a lot of thoughts in this area. I've got my pilot project, Wiki Tribune, where I'm trying to work on some of these ideas. So I always like to step back and say, well, what has really shifted and changed? So one of the things that's shifted is the loss of the classified ads. So that naturally, that was a technological link up, that somebody was bringing a pile of paper to your door every day and it made sense to bring classified ads along with that. Now those are completely separated and that was always going to happen. Craigslist, eBay, there's other places that people use and there's no reason that should be tied to the news. Then there's reader revenue, so direct subscription revenue or paying at the newsstand. That has been really devastated as well because of online delivery makes it hard to charge for news, although we're seeing some exciting changes there. So the New York Times has their digital subscribers have gone from less than 1 million to over 3 million, last numbers I heard, and that's exciting. Because that's really the best revenue. If you're getting revenue, if your readers are paying, that really aligns your incentives in a healthy way. Then there's the corporate advertising, the classified, the display advertising. And that took a huge hit, but that's beginning to recover. But there's something new there, a new problem. So the old problem with that sort of advertising was a sort of a Noam Chomsky type of concern about to what extent are news organizations able to resist their big advertisers. So would the New York Times really run an expose on General Motors if that's their biggest advertiser? Well, I think that problem was actually reasonably well handled. Never perfect, of course, but in general, the New York Times back in the day knew that they had to do the right thing news-wise. They put into place internal institutional parameters to make that happen because ultimately they needed the trust of the reader more than they needed the revenue from any one advertiser. So I think it was okay. But now that's really shifted and that So as we've had other sources of revenue, they become more dependent on the advertisers. But they're shifted in a good way as well. The interesting thing nowadays is that with programmatic advertising, so all this means is everywhere you go on the internet, if you're like me, you see the same ads no matter where you go. They know what you're interested in. I like boats, so I read boat magazines and I visit boat websites. So everywhere I go on the internet, I get boat ads. Boats I can't afford, so it's boat porn, but I get boating ads. And what that means is the boat manufacturers have zero influence over the editorial policies of any newspaper because those newspapers don't even know those boat ads are on there. They come through the ad networks and so forth. So that problem's been solved, but there's a worse problem that comes out of it, which is that when I'm looking at Reddit, a huge message board, or some YouTube, or I'm looking at a very expensive piece of investigative journalism done by The Guardian, I'm seeing the exact same ads and they're paying exactly the same price, which means that The Guardian has a huge business problem. All the serious newspapers have a huge business problem. It's very expensive to do quality journalism, and you're competing head-to-head in a new way against everything on the internet, which gives rise to clickbait. Basically the incentives in front of even serious news organizations struggle with this to say, I remember seeing one quality online magazine who published a piece, an opinion piece saying, hey, look, we're just putting our hand up to say to people, here's our problem. We paid a senior journalist for 3 weeks to do this investigative piece. It was nothing earth-shattering, but meaningful. It got published. It moved the needle on an issue. We felt like this was important, and we're really proud of it. The same day we published that, we published a listicle, a 23 cute cat picture article by a millennial intern in the office that got the same amount of traffic. And we're just putting our hand up to say, from a business perspective, we should just hire a bunch of kids to write funny stuff, because that's what gets traffic in viral media, social sharing, all that. Whereas this other piece, we lost money on it. And so that's a problem, a fundamental problem for the business model, because everything competes head-to-head against everything else. So for me, I think there's two potential paths to solution. One is revenue from readers. I think that payment mechanisms have gotten a lot easier. So as I say, I read boat magazines. I actually subscribe to several. I pay for them on my Kindle on my phone, whereas I had stopped. I don't think I'd subscribed to a magazine for years. Paper was inconvenient. I could find what I wanted online, but I'm happy to pay for good quality work. Things I'm interested in reading, I pay for it. The subscription model I've mentioned, that seems to be doing a bit better, but even like the Guardian model, where the Guardian is just asking people at the bottom of every story, hey, would you help out? That's been very successful for them. They've substantially increased their reader revenue. I was on the board of The Guardian for a while, so I take part of the blame, because I said to them at that time, their model was around tote bags and membership and discounted museum admissions. And I was like, nobody wants a tote bag. Nobody wants a discounted. They want to support The Guardian. So just ask them to support The Guardian. They were being very British about it. And I was like, that's what Wikipedia does. We just say, if you love it, you should chip in. And that's working for them. And so I think that's some things. But then what I'm working on as well with Wiki Tribune is to say, actually, we also need to address the cost side of things. To say, for every dollar in revenue we get from the readers, how can we direct that to journalists and not have journalists doing stuff that other people could do? So even things like copy editing. People do copy editing as a hobby all the time at Wikipedia. They do copy editing on all kinds of wikis. They do desk research. People are very intrigued. So If a newspaper wanted to do a story about, a fact check about measles and vaccines, hey, there are people who love that sort of thing. I nearly did it myself just because I was interested this morning, right? If we can find ways of bringing more thoughtful people, Wikipedia-type people, into the newsroom, into the news process in a way that's not condescending, that is not assuming they're just the idiots in the comments yelling at each other, then quality work can be done, and then we leave the work that's harder for community members to do, for the journalists. It's hard for community members to pick up the phone and ring someone for an interview. It's people are shy. I don't know how to do that. It's not easy. There's a lot of other kinds of work and thoughtful things that journalists, professional journalists do. I always give this example. What was the score in, last night's football match? Literally, there are millions of people who can write that piece. They're saying, here's what happened, Manchester United game last night. this happened in the first half, this happened in the second half, these are the penalties. That story could be written by lots of people. Meanwhile, your sport journalist could be doing an in-depth investigation of the corruption at FIFA instead of wasting time writing sort of lightweight day-to-day stuff that lots of people could get involved with. But we haven't figured out how. What do people want to do? How do we help them do it? How do we let them do it? So I'm trying to figure something out about that. I'm having fun.
So it seems to me there's a related question to this, which is the broader question about the monetization of data. So you have eschewed that in the Wikipedia model. You said, I'm giving you data for free.
Yeah.
And if you like it, voluntarily contribute to support the site. It's the opposite of the monetization of data.
And we don't sell any data. We don't even track very much. If someone came to us, a marketer, and said, we would love to get the IP addresses of people who are reading about boats because we want to try to sell them boats on other websites even. And if we could better target people because we know they're interested in science or history or whatever it might be they're interested in, we just don't. We have no interest in that. We would say, actually, we don't keep up with that data. We have a very strict policy. We keep some data for a short period of time for a long time, we kept no data. On the access logs, I just sent them to the trash. Like, I didn't keep data for a long time, partly because in the early days, we didn't have enough money to pay for servers to hold the data. I was like, what am I going to do with the data? I'll just delete it. Don't have room for it. But that's the kind of thing that today we just don't have. We keep a little bit so our developers can see how people are using the website, but then it's gone.
Let me rephrase it. I'm pretty certain that Wikipedia will never do this, but let me sketch out a different, more equitable and more progressive way of monetizing data, which might be in a parallel universe. There's 40 million people coming to a repository and they keep coming, and the data that they give is wildly valuable. And instead of that accruing to a small group of shareholders somewhere in Silicon Valley, who most of the time you give up your data not really knowing that how wildly valuable it is because you think you've transacted well. If we created some kind of data co-op or some way in which people, it was more transparent to them, the value of what they're giving up, and they're either paid for that data or that goes into some kind of repository which is used to fund coding academies for poor kids or high-speed internet in poor communities or more progressive deployment of technology in a world that's deeply bifurcated. Are there ways that you've seen or would support or get behind in which data is treated more like a public good rather than a private commodity?
Well, I think that's really complicated and really hard. I've talked to some people about various ideas that I wasn't persuaded by. I think a part of the issue is that a lot of the data, I think one of the big concerns people have is not so much that their data is being used to change what ads they're seeing or to sell them things. That's not the concern people have. People have concerns that the data is being gathered at all in this really comprehensive way. It's rather creepy to think about that somewhere, not even Google or Facebook, but some ad network people, they have a very good profile of what your interests are based on your web browsing history, because they've tracked you across dozens and dozens of sites, possibly including Facebook, possibly including Google ad supported websites and things like that. And what does that really mean for our privacy and things like that? That, I think, is a big concern that people have. The other thing is that, you know, there are certain I have no idea what Amazon's data purchasing policy is or where they get data from. So I'll only focus on the assumption that the main thing they get is the data from when I'm on Amazon, which I find to be fantastic. And it makes complete logical sense to me and doesn't seem intrusive. I go on Amazon, I'm shopping around for stuff. They give me other suggestions of something that's similar. If I'm looking for, I was just looking for a little, almost like a toy football goal for my kids. And I look, they range in price from 20 quid to 100 quid. I couldn't decide which one to get. I got bored and I left. If I go back next week, they're going to show me a couple of football goals and say, hey, did you still want to buy football? That's exactly what would happen if I went into a local sports shop and the owner saw me again and said, hey, did you ever get that football goal? Did you decide which one? I don't find that use of data to be intrusive or obnoxious. It's what they're there for and it's what I'm there for. It would be really weird, though, for me, right, if they're tracking where I am and they see I've visited the Conduit Club here in Mayfair, and then they try to sell me conduit pipes because they've been confused. Like, I don't really want that. I don't really want that data leak over from different areas of my life. And I think that's a concern people have. But it's really, really hard to figure out how do we address that in a way that makes sense. And doesn't embody sort of temptations to censorship and you know, there's a lot of tough problems.
So let me ask you a question around temptations to censorship and your earlier points around the libertarian versus the regulated approach on online. The Prime Minister of New Zealand just announced yesterday the Christchurch call, partnered with President Macron in France. Digital leaders in the G7 are now likely to take this forward, which is a kind of much more assertive effort to try and ban hate and extremism and live streaming of the kind of massacres and violence that we saw in New Zealand, and to try and say social media platforms now have responsibilities and liabilities in a way that requires a degree of, you know, regulation / censorship. How do you reconcile these, the remarkable openness, the good, the participatory nature of the net with the kind of concomitant responsibilities that arise when it gets used for such demonstrably evil ends?
Well, I mean, I think this is a huge and very complex topic. So I think one of the things that I would come down on is the side of remembering that the very concept of an open platform is really important and really crucial. And I think we can draw on much older models and ways of thinking about responsibility that still make sense. Like, the fundamentals of human beings haven't changed. So for example, if you own a pub and someone comes into the pub and starts spouting nonsense or libel, as the pub owner, you can't be held responsible for that, clearly. If somebody comes into the pub and they start a fight, generally you have certain responsibilities, but that's not your fault. Although, if somebody is clearly visibly drunk and agitated and you give them more alcohol, you can take on certain responsibilities that you haven't acted in a thoughtful way. And even that sort of thing has been controversial in some jurisdictions, but in general, that people understand that is, you know, it's not your fault. I mean, it's basic common human understanding. So if someone like Facebook offers a platform where I can go on today and start live streaming and say, hey, everybody, I'm here in London. I did a podcast this morning and now I'm going to go work with my team at Wikitribune. You know, whatever people do on, I never do that myself, but people do that sort of thing. That's a great thing in society and all kinds of good have come from that. And equally well, I could start live streaming doing something terrible. And I don't think we can hold Facebook responsible for that at that level. On the other hand, they could be held responsible for things like hosting it in the long term. If it's threats of violence, for example, or if it's, actual crimes being committed. And I think the question would be is, okay, are we satisfied with how quickly they're responding? And what is the right answer to that? And how do we regulate that in such a fashion that Facebook doesn't just say, actually, now we're going to auto-detect any mention of the word gun or anything that sounds like a gunshot, and we're going to block those videos immediately? Because now that's overreach, right? Maybe I'm going to do my podcast about the gangster movies, right? And I'm going to talk about it. I'm going to show little clips and you're going to see and hear gunshots, and how do they deal with that? And am I suddenly blocked and we're not allowed to talk about the problem of gun crime? Because as soon as you mention the word gun, it's not, doesn't get through. And so it's a really hard problem. And I read, and I would love to learn more. I'm assuming we're all waiting for a report in the longer term, more reflective, but about the Christchurch video, I read a report that said it was uploaded 1 million times to Facebook. And what I was curious to know is, was that 1 million different people who had downloaded the video and decided to re-upload it? Because that's a whole other scale of a social problem, right? If there's actually a million people who think I should upload a video of graphic violence, why were they doing that? What, were they supporting it? Probably not. Were they just titillating? Were they trying to get clicks? What was the mo-? Like, that's a different problem. Or was it 200 bots uploading it over and over and over again for some other bad, malicious purpose, like clickbait or something like that? Those are very different cases, and how we should think about the whole problem. If we say, look, the problem is millions and millions of people want to upload and share disturbing content. Okay, that's something I'm not happy about, but that's not something that I think the right lever is to push on Facebook about that. Like, that's what people want to do. We have to think about society in some deep way, and education and values. Versus if we say, actually, it's traced down to 200 Russian bots who are constantly trying to stir up racial hatred, and they were being shared with captions designed to stir up racial hatred, and Facebook did nothing about blocking those 200 accounts, but simply took down the video one after another. I can say, Facebook, come on. Like, that's not the will of the people, and that's not what people are trying to share as a matter of free expression that we may not agree with. That's actually somebody subverting the platform. You should do something about that. And so how do you do that in a way that, how do you bring law into that in a way that doesn't just encourage them to go, right, well, our executives could go to jail if we don't do the right thing, so we're going to stop letting people upload video. That would be disturbing.
A final question, because we've strayed over so many incredible terrains and you're so uniquely positioned to answer some of these questions. And it comes to the sort of segue from the Russian bot question, which is election laws. Mm. So once upon a time, when elections were done in a more analog way, we came to feel that there should be limits that you place on the ability of people with economic power, who also therefore acquire concentrated political power, to be able to buy the hearts and minds of citizens. And in order to create an electorally level playing field, we create expenditure limits to how much you can spend, in what way, on what forms and what media. And that's obviously been eroded by, in the United States, but holds largely in Europe. We now have platforms where both state actors, but also small amounts of committed individuals, for reasons that we've discussed earlier, can propagate electorally salient amounts of information that may indeed have swayed some of the most critical elections of our time, in ways that election laws don't really quite track. Mm. And this is another question that, you know, the people who are in favor of open platforms and are skeptical of regulation, but also understand that we, with great power comes great responsibility, is a question. So where do you come down on the balance for how we use these platforms in the context of the most important political choices of our time?
Well, I mean, I think one of the first and easiest steps is around transparency. So I think that Facebook should adopt, and I think they have to some extent. I'm not an expert on their policies, as I've not tried to subvert any elections recently, but they should have an absolute policy around all advertising, but particularly political advertising, that when I see an ad, it is accompanied with a message explaining who paid for it. And when I click on that, it shouldn't say, this was paid for by the Committee of Concerned Citizens, which tells me nothing, right? It should be actually to say, we won't accept funding from organizations. We won't sell ads to organizations who do not reveal very detailed, and they can have a set standard. It's not like they have to make it up from on their own, right? There are legal standards in different places around the world to say, you need to say down to the person, who are your major donors? Where is this money coming from? So that people can, and because an entity as important and as strong as Facebook could actually demand that that be done in a consistent way with consistent APIs, consistent XML markup, so that, and published and made publicly, openly available, so that all kinds of interested public interest advocacy groups can actually download that data, churn through the data, and say, actually, here's, you know, you might be surprised to know that XYZ company funded 300 different groups all pushing on the same issue. And so you wouldn't notice it if you just looked at each group individually. But in fact, they're a major player in this area, and they've managed to conceal it through a lot of small, you know, those are the kinds of things that we could get to with data. And that's an easy first step. It doesn't even involve trying to ban it or whatever. It's just say, look, sunshine, great disinfection, that people can then say, okay, right. And journalists can write news stories saying, oh, you might be surprised to know how much did the music industry spend on the copyright fight in the EU recently, something I was involved in, right? Nobody really can tell you that. It's very hard to get those numbers. I found a couple of irritating MEPs who I couldn't imagine that their arguments even made sense to them, but I was just like, you're just a paid show, but I couldn't figure out their funding. And that's in the EU, which should be able to make this quite a transparent thing. So I think those kinds of things are really important. And, you know, for Facebook to be reporting on things. The other thing, you know, that you would see with some of those patterns, I was told about some ads during the Trump campaign, which were very narrowly targeted at evangelical black women. And they were basically voter suppression ads. So they basically were saying, you're pro-life because evangelical black women would be generally pro-life, and Hillary is pro-choice. And in your area, Hillary's going to win no matter how you vote, or Trump's going to win no matter how you vote, but you can send a message to Hillary by staying home. And it was even to say, oh, obviously, Trump's a buffoon. You're never going to vote for Trump. It's that sort of thing, right? Meanwhile, the same organization is got different ads with different messages, and they pick out messages. I saw there were ads here in the UK, vegan ads, pro-Brexit vegan ads, saying, well, finally, if we get rid of all those EU rules, we can pass pro-vegan laws in the UK. Well, I'm sure you could make the equally case, like, we're going to bring back fox hunting if we didn't have the EU. Right? You can make up any kind of nonsense targeted to people for their what they know and what they value and have influence. And it's really, really important then that in real time, as fast as possible, journalists and others are able to untangle that, to warn people to say, wow, look, the Trump campaign is paying for ads that say this and the exact opposite, and they're targeting with these people. So look out. And Facebook should make that aware, make people aware of that. To say, here's some of the other ads this organization is promoting that you might not agree with. I mean, they have the data, they have the algorithms to be able to move in this direction. I'm not suggesting regulation. As you said, I'm not against it. I just think we need to be very cautious about it. But there are a lot of ideas that they could try, that they should try, to say, we want to be responsible. We want to both respect that you don't have to agree with Facebook's political views to post on Facebook, right? We're not going to censor your alternative views. We're not even going to ban your political ads as long as they're legal and within certain parameters, even if we disagree with them. But we are going to make everybody be more transparent, and we're going to try to help people see all sides of an issue.
Jimmy Wales, that has been a masterclass in the internet, in responsibility, in regulation, and how we come to acquire knowledge. And you have been at the forefront of these debates, and will continue to be, I'm certain, in the years to come. So we're enormously grateful that you've given us your time, and I'm certain that there are many, many listeners who will take a great deal from this conversation. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Conduit Conversations. Feel free to subscribe. This podcast is available on all major podcast platforms. Please also visit theconduit.com, where you can find more information on The Conduit and our community of change makers. Thank you.